I don't know what's wrong with people. It's like the culture of trolls.
The culture of trolls.
The culture of trolls. We live in it, brother. Let me tell you. We do. We live in a culture of trolls.
Trolls.
What's the popular social media website?
We're ready. 3, 2.
Hubbo. Is that it?
News from the French.
This is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grillion Bunker, I'm Micah Hanks. And that means this, of course, is the Grillion Report. Happy Memorial Day, everybody, and of course to all of you around the world elsewhere, we hope that your week is off to a wonderful start. And here at the outset of the program, let me just tell you, we've got a lot to cover, only so little time to do that. I've often said it before, that's the problem with time travel. No one ever seems to be able to find the time, so we'll cram as much as we can in tonight. We've got some interesting UFO debunking to do, as well as mysteries of biology. Everything from the extreme size that certain monsters the deep may reach. And of course, an old favorite of ours, the Himalayan Yeti. Does it exist? Well, most will tell you no, and that indeed may be the case, but there is an interesting tie-in with the history of Yeti research that has to do with one of those enduring mysteries we have discussed here on this program. It has to do with South America, and they even have tie-ins with famous programs like Operation Paperclip. More of that in the second hour, and of course, news, emails from folks like you, and other analysis of those things, I guess, which really are deemed fringe, but in truth, I think they don't necessarily have to always be that. I'll clarify that statement a little here in a moment. First, allow me to introduce the man with the plan back at home in Master Control, Fort Smith, Arkansas, Mr. Race Hobbs. How are you, sir?
Good, Micah. How are you?
I'm well, and a happy Memorial Day to you. You know, I just said that I don't think that the kind of things that we discuss on a show like this necessarily have to be relegated to the lunatic fringe, and I was thinking about this today. I met the Reverend Oakley and the lovely Lady Sydney, which are really two of my very favorite traveling companions. Matt Oakley, of course, is well known to longtime listeners of this show. We met for an espresso at this cool little coffee shop over in East Asheville earlier today. Decided actually to make the long trip up the elevator, back up to the above ground world. Put on my sunglasses, hadn't seen the light of day for days, and ventured out. But we were talking, and you know, Matt and I, we'd had this talk a few days ago where he'd said, you know, the thing that I find less attractive about UFOs today, or any other similar subject, as compared with when we started the Grillion Report back in, gosh, it was late 2010 or early 2011. But he said, it's not so much that the subject matter isn't interesting, but it is the simple fact, and I think that this is a fact, he said, that those who have chosen to believe typically are going to defend their belief, and those who have chosen to be naysayers or debunkers or skeptics are going to continue to defend the idea that there is nothing to be made of UFOs. He said that there is so little medium ground, there's so little cooperation between the believer or advocate groups and the skeptic or debunker groups. And he said, doing a program on a weekly basis like Grillion Report, for me, he said, came to a point where I realized a certain kind of frustration in knowing that there was never going to be that common ground in most instances, which, funny enough, I think that more and more as the listeners of this show reach out to me, Race, what they indicate to me over time is just that. They say, you know, you actually take a very good, open-minded, skeptical approach to this. We don't have to feel like we're wacky ourselves listening to a show like yours, because you do try to break down intelligently and very credibly, and also, from time to time, adding a little humor, you know, making it listenable, making it a fun show to listen to. But you guys really do take a very serious approach, and when necessary, an extremely skeptical one toward these subjects. And so, while I understand someone like Matt's frustration, completely. There are times also where I kind of think that the only way forward is to try and understand what relevance these subjects may have. Oftentimes I find, as we'll look at during the second hour, you start with a popular urban legend or a folktale or a UFO sighting or something like this, and you work your way down with what little facts you may be able to glean over time. And over time, I believe that rather than just dismissing at the outset, if you really dig deeply enough, you will find a grain of truth. Very seldom what you find in the end, very seldom does that really resemble what you thought you'd find at the outset. And I sometimes think that in the broader sense of disclosure and UFO research and things like this, most people's preconceptions by the end of the day are going to be thrown out, but at the end of the day, we will also probably, once we have followed this thread to the end, we will learn new things about ourselves and about the world and about geopolitics and perhaps also the idea of different kinds of intelligence in our midst. I mean, make of that what you will. Those are my predictions, but I think that usually what we hope to find in the end is seldom what actually is resultant. I mean, do you ever feel, Race, that sometimes things do get so convoluted and you have to kind of step back and you just begin to have to realize that, you know, there are going to be people's ideas, their attitudes, and their opinions, but in the midst of that, somewhere in the midst of that great big dust cloud, that storm, in fact, that there is truth to be found if people are willing to look hard enough?
Well, absolutely. There's no question about it. It's out there. It's just a matter of who wants to be dedicated to learn it and find it. I think that, you know, just like in the political climate today, America is screaming at the top of their lungs that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer and the middle class get less than even that. It's a revolution on the horizon of some sort. Something is about to change in a big way. And in the same, I feel in the UFO community and in paranormal in general. That's a broad brush there, but I do feel it in the political climate and I do feel it in the UFO community. And I have had to step back three times in 26 years where it's gotten to be so much and it's not what you thought it was going to be. And then, you know, you kind of have to step back, reflect. And then, you know, good folks like yourself who express, a good, solid skepticism, you know, amongst all of this mayhem, it really sort of helps us come back home to where we need to be. And because we can get caught up, you know, it's easy to get caught up in this storm, in this whirlwind. And yeah, I think that's a credit to folks like yourself that do a really good job of kind of keeping their foot on the bag.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, as you were saying, that you feel much in the same way that the political tide is changing. I mean, and that's very much the case. You know, we're seeing people even on the right and the left saying we should get a third-party candidate in this race. Very interestingly, many people seem to be kind of reacting in similar ways with the whole UFO disclosure thing, especially in terms of there being a political tie-in. So it's interesting because as a researcher of the unexplained, talking with Matt, he was expressing his frustration with, you know, there are believers who are going to believe, there are skeptics who are going to be skeptical. And he said that fight is always going to exist, and it makes, in my mind, so much more clear the necessity for, I think, a kind of balanced, a centrist, a kind of an independent-minded approach, skeptical, but also willing to account for facts that seem to play to the other side just as well. And you know what's funny, Race, is that as much as I apply that to the unexplained, as my skepticism has deepened over the years, I find politically that I've begun to do the same thing. I mean, anymore, with American politics, I feel more and more like the two-party system, necessary though it may be, is not resonating with young people. I mean, we see the support Bernie Sanders gets, for instance, and also, really, in truth, the support that Donald Trump gets. Well, both of these characters are extremely independent-minded, and more young voters especially are saying they would prefer an independent candidate. They would prefer, again, a third party ticket. They are not happy with the typical, or the at least those who are, you know, taken to be the front runners in this election. And I think that really there's an interesting kind of a breakdown, whether you look at the unexplained, whether you look at politics, whether you look at religion, more and more people, I think, are willing to kind of take this, again, what I would call kind of a balanced or a centrist kind of a mindset, that we don't have to be extreme in our belief or disbelief, in our pros or our cons. And that doesn't mean just try and make everybody happy and stand in the center. I think it merely means maybe we shouldn't allow a very polarized ideology color everything that we believe about these subjects. And so I actually feel vindicated to an extent when we do a show like this. We're willing to look at skepticism, we're willing to look at belief, we're willing to look at facts, most importantly, and try and discern what we can. And in the broader sense, I don't know that what I've found along this strange path that has become the Graylian Report, I don't know that I've found the kind of things that I hoped to find. I certainly haven't found vindication. I've learned a lot, but the picture that has emerged is vastly different. Vastly different from what I expected to find along the way. As many people are saying, look, we really need to change our attitudes and our approaches politically. We're hearing the same sort of thing. I'm not the only one who's been saying it. As it relates to UFO research, we've now got, you know, lover or hater, Hillary Clinton saying that, you know, she's going to do her best to try and get UFO files released. But then there's been this story that I've actually been seeing a lot of people carrying over the last few days. And it's interesting because I spoke to the subscribers over the weekend a little bit about this. This story that I've been seeing widely circulated has to do with the idea that, you know, before the election, before the next commander-in-chief actually is inaugurated next January, that the Obama administration may actually release a trove of UFO files. But what's funny is, best I can tell, this seems to have stemmed from one of the Paradigm Research Group's newsletters that they had sent out, Stephen Bassett. And the day that the story broke, I subscribed to their newsletter. We've had Steve on the show before. I don't agree with him on all points, but he's an interesting guy to talk to, and his advocacy, his political action in relation to the UFO subject is quite interesting. But I kind of see this same hopefulness that we see, especially among millennial voters, as far as people's attitudes toward UFO research. And so this story has been circulating, oh my gosh, Obama might release these UFO files. Something might come of it. When in fact, the day that the story actually broke, which was sometime last week, the Paradigm Research Group issued a bulletin again later that day saying, hold on now, let's not get ahead of ourselves. This is what we'd said. We say we've been lobbying to government. We've been working with this truth embargo, as he calls it, Mr. Bassett. And they said, we have not been given any information, for instance, from a whistleblower that there's going to be a large amount of UFO data released. That's just not the reality that we're dealing with right now. We might hope that there'll be some information released, but the media has already taken away and run with it. Disclose TV, that's an entertaining website. they've even linked to some Graylian articles over the years, you know, but I mean, there's a lot of very sensational stuff that appear on there. It's kind of like YouTube for the fringe community.
And, I saw it on MSN.
Well, now you've seen a lot of things on the mainstream, and see, in this hour later, maybe we'll go ahead and go to some articles, because I've actually noticed a lot of people talking about the way that the mainstream media is also reporting on UFOs, and not just talking about Hillary Clinton says she might release these files, Obama might release these files, whether or not the, you know, the source of that information even agrees with those statements. One of the articles that I'd come across, I think the Texas UFO website had actually carried this, and they were talking about their concern with a YouTube video that was aired on Fox News recently. And actually, a friend of mine was the very guy who had commented on this, Clayton Morris, who does the Paranormal Report with Jim Harold and I from time to time. He was the original co-host, and he still comes and hangs out and sits in with us. And I stay in touch with Clayton, you know, from time to time. I think he's a nice guy. And on Fox and Friends, they had actually, I'm sure Clayton had a little something to do with this, because when he can, he always tries to get UFO stories in on their programs. But the particular video that they were commenting on, I think there may be a few issues with this. We have a little audio.
The internet is buzzing this morning over this bizarre video shot near a military base in Dayton, Ohio, that appears to show an object hovering and disappearing into the clouds. Here's another sighting of a similar object, also allegedly seen in the skies over Dayton, believed to be the same UFO. Well, Clayton, what do you think about this? I think you have an opinion.
Wright-Patterson Air Force Base there, long believed to be housing all sorts of military craft. There have been a number of military members that have gone on the record about what they're housing at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio.
The truth is out there. I'm on it.
You can just end it right there. I love they can't escape without an X-Files reference. If they don't play the song, they have to still say the truth is out there, whether it's articles, you know. Now, again, that information about Wright-Patterson Air Force Base being provided by Clayton Morris, very knowledgeable about the subculture and the information that surrounds UFOs, that history associated with it. And yes, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base does play, previously known as Wright Field, it does play quite a role in the history of UFOs. The object they're describing there was a video purportedly uploaded to YouTube, but of course has been made popular by a YouTube account called Secure Team 10. And there are a lot of mixed opinions about Fox News. And again, as you already said, this is only one of many instances where the mainstream media has been covering UFOs recently, causing some to say, okay, really, what is their aim? What is their objective in doing so? Especially when they report on a video like this, because many people are skeptical of the Secure Team 10 YouTube video account and the gentleman behind it known as Tyler Glockner. Now, we have discussed him a bit on the show here before. I've said that there are some fairly compelling photos and videos that have appeared on that account. Others aren't so sure in the sense that they are concerned that for a YouTube account to be as active as Secure Team 10 appears to be, and again, this would be speculation, but perhaps very warranted just as well, for them to be as active as they are, how do they obtain as many videos as they do? And, of course, videos that show like what Fox News have been talking about. Specifically on that one, what you see is something that I had thought and I've seen described elsewhere as lightning bolt, roughly lightning bolt shaped, which is significant, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But this object has been described as looking somewhat similar to a kite, as described at the Anomalist news source this morning, who reported on this. Some have said that it looks like a balloon, and whatever it is appears to be drifting behind clouds. Now, when I looked at it, and what's interesting is when Secure Team 10 featured this video at their website, they also commented on photographs that had been supplied to them, allegedly, which seemed to show the same strange kind of lightning bolt-shaped object. Interestingly, there is a photograph that appeared at a website, UFOInternationalProject.com, and there was an article that they had done on Tyler Glockner and Secure Team 10 in which they called it Secure Team Hoax. I mean, they think that the entire thing is bogus. And interestingly, the photo that appears on that article at the top of the page shows Glockner, shows the Secure Team 10 logo, shows him sitting in front of his computer. And then there's this lightning bolt-shaped decal, or something akin to it, there in the picture, which immediately kind of, you know, put up red flags for me, because it's very similar, I'll say, to what appears in this video. Now, we can't say that Glockner faked the entire thing. Somebody could have faked it and sent it to him. But as David Marler and I have been talking about at the Eureka Springs conference recently, video and photos of UFOs these days are next to no good. I mean, very seldom do they ever give us any kind of really good information. One question people are asking about the footage that Glockner put up at the Secure Team 10 website, which, again, Clayton and the folks at Fox News reported on as well. Hey, yeah, the video looks really good. But if something this distinct were being seen in multiple different locations, caught on video, and then somebody else takes a photograph of it in the daytime, obviously a different location, different time of day, same object appears, shouldn't there be a lot of people getting video and photographs of this? Shouldn't more people be reporting on this? Shouldn't there be more media agencies that are reporting on the apparent presence of the object rather than merely the video that shows up on the account? And this UFO International Project article, they say, unfortunately, Secure Team 10 has stepped into the UFO spotlight. It's sad when a person who makes profit through deception is elevated to this position, and it clearly shows poor character quality and morals. And they say there are more than a few YouTube channels like this that are quote-unquote bringing home the bacon by faking videos, which seems to be one of the reasons that someone would put up a YouTube video account like this and then attempt to try and produce regular content featuring UFOs. Well, of course, it's going to be the video equivalent of what we call clickbaiting on these websites, where they have this catchy-looking title that makes you click, oh yeah, sure, I want to see semi-nude pictures of whatever, you know, Hollywood starlet is the flavor of the month or week or whatever. And then you go click that link. The same sort of thing works when you have incredible new footage. Incredible new footage of a UFO. Yeah. It's fairly, you know, disconcerting. So, that said, I'm not really impressed with this video. It is interesting, though, that the media from time to time feature these stories. I think in the case of Fox News, it probably has less to do with them trying to do clickbaiting themselves. Obviously, it's a sensational story. But knowing that Clayton, and knowing Clayton personally, knowing that Clayton had actually put that video up tells me that it had to do with his interest, which is not just in UFOs, it's also in trying to get more of a mainstream discussion about that subject going. So I think that that's a good thing. But the problem is that, again, in this age of computer manipulation and CGI, like Marler has said and like many others have argued, I don't think that these videos and these photographs are going to be much good to us in furthering our knowledge of UFOs, let alone proving that they exist. Race, do you remember those those weird-looking drone photographs that started appearing, you know, allegedly over California, but they ended up being called the Carrot, C-A-R-E-T, the Carrot drones from a number of years ago.
I do.
Yeah, and there are a lot of people in the UFO community that maintain that those are legitimate, even though, again, I think that you could have looked at them at the time and said that, great though they looked, they were obviously hoaxes. UFO Hunters did an episode about this. They had James Carrion, who at the time was still the national director of MUFON, discussing those on camera. Boy, he really took a turn for the skeptic, which, again, I think many people do after they've dealt with this kind of thing for long enough. But these pictures and this video, that's a lot of the same sort of thing. I was reminded very much of those so-called Carrot drones from a number of years ago. And again, if you go online and you Google C-A-R-E-T, Carrot drone photos, you'll see and may remember what I'm talking about. Race, what's your opinion of those photographs?
I don't know enough about them to have an opinion one way or another. I know there are a lot of people who say that, you know, these are parts made from other things, but then when, you know, I talked to Linda Moulton Howe about them, because she seems to take a lot of guff about it from the UFO community, and her investigation through intelligence agencies and others lead her to believe that they were real. I appreciate Linda, and I respect Linda highly, and I know there's a lot of things that she says that I can't wrap my brain around, and but there's also a lot of compelling evidence to suggest that there might be something to it. So I'm one to say that they're probably hoaxes, but I have really not done extensive research into those.
You know, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but hey, you know, let's go ahead and become conspiracy theorists for a minute. As I kind of said at the outset, and as we're going to look at in the second hour even more deeply, I have often said that if you really want to understand UFO phenomena and you dig deeply enough into this and the literature, what you may not find that you had hoped to find at the outset is evidence, irrefutable evidence of the existence of ET, or at least of the existence of exotic aircraft, the likes of the UFOs that we've all read about and seen on TV. But what you may find is that there have indeed been instances where perhaps hoaxes or manipulations have been presented to the public. The question is not whether or not they are real. And again, for the typical skeptic, it kind of ends at, okay, these are bogus, so go ahead and toss it out the window. We don't need to look at this anymore. What's even worse is even if a good photograph does show up, they'll still say it obviously could have been hoaxed. I remember Bill Fox and Bob Ashmore managing to get photographs of what I think is a natural plasma over Brown Mountain. The photos weren't even that good, but they obviously were not photoshopped. And I took them to a skeptic friend of mine. He did everything he could. He tried to plot them, you know, in terms of we knew the date, we knew the rough time, we knew where Jupiter would have been in the sky at that time. He knew it wasn't any celestial object. When he had ruled out all things that he knew it could have been that were prosaic, he said, but I can't prove that they didn't photoshop it. And I said, now just stop right there. I know these two men. Both of these men are formerly employees at Bell Laboratories. They're good friends of mine. And every summer when they come down here to a vacation, where they go to, again, every year, go back to Brown Mountain and try and spot these things again, they manage to photograph them at least once, and they've seen them numerous times. I said, I know these guys. They are not going to hoax these images, and frankly, I don't think either of them would use or be adept enough with a program like Photoshop to have hoaxed that photograph themselves. So at the end of the day, I mean, there are many skeptics who will say, look, the bottom line is it could have been hoaxed, therefore, in likelihood, it was hoaxed. And if it isn't a hoax, we can't prove that it's real, and therefore, there's nothing else to say here. But I would beg to differ, and here's why. There is historical precedent for the release of bad information, and yes, by government agencies. The CIA has a long history of doing this kind of a thing. And if the information is presented in a way that looks good enough or bad enough, but nonetheless has a discernible effect on a group, a societal group, a social group within our society, I should say. If there is a effect that can be garnered, from time to time, there may be reasons why bad information is leaked about UFOs, and it has nothing to do with whether or not UFOs actually exist. It has everything to do with controlling the public. Now, people laugh, and they can roll their eyes and say, okay, conspiracy theory Hank's right here. Go ahead, Alex Jones, tell us some more. If you read Mark Pilkington's book, Mirage Men. The documentary film is really good too, but in his book, he talks about the divisions of government formed shortly after the end of the Second World War. I should go grab a copy of the book, in fact, here in a second, and actually give a better source citation about this. but psychological manipulation of the public by various branches of government is a very real facet of U.S. history as it relates to intelligence operations. Trying to steer the American public and their attitudes and to shape a kind of Western culture that was conducive to control, which of course fosters peace and unity, and of course less apparent civil disturbance and questioning. If anything, I think it's just the opposite. You know, psyops and the slow release of information, operations like MK Ultra, all different kinds of psychological operations, COINTELPRO, you know, the slow release of information about these kind of things over the years have only fostered more distrust for government in the American populace. But I think their original aim had been to try and very quietly do what they could to control the way we thought, the way that Western culture would form around our lives and how we would act within that cookie-cutter mold of reality that they were trying to present for us.
Well, Michael, listen, I want to jump in here. I think that's a good point, a valid point. But, you know, one thing to keep in mind here is every government on the planet has done the exact same thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And number two, that it's this generation, this time in American history is not the only time that the enemy has lived and existed from within the borders of the United States. So a lot of disinformation is put out there because of the enemies of the state who are here amongst us. It may not necessarily be to control our culture or to control our people per se, as much as it is to throw off intelligence agencies and spies and agents within us, well, within the United States, I should say, that are trying to subvert us.
Hey, now that is an extremely good point, Race. That is, I'll tell you, again, one thing, once again, just to add to what you're talking about, that there is plenty of historical precedent for is the existence of moles within our own government and, of course, our own existing in other governments around the world. I mean, spies, the real world of espionage, yes, absolutely, there have to be a system of, if you want to call them, internal checks and balances that can distort certain information and that can be used to vet another individual with regard to the kind of information that they may have or may be seeking to obtain. The entire Maury Island UFO incident, it has been speculated, and I think Mark Pilkington even was one who proposed this in Mirage Men, which is funny because everybody tries to say he's a disinformation agent. I like Pilk. I think he's great. We need to get him on the show. We've talked about this for months, and he was just really busy back in January. But one of the things he says about Maury Island in Mirage Men is that it very well may have been that that entire scenario was put together in a way so as to try and test, engage the interests of Kenneth Arnold himself, who, again, there's a long history of this. Nick Redfern has written a book about it, too, On the Trail of the Saucer Spies. The concern by U.S. government agencies that UFO researchers might have been operating under the guise of interest in extraterrestrials when, in fact, they were trying to get information about secret aviation technologies being developed here in the United States. And we know, again, that the CIA and that the Air Force, and sometimes the both, working in conjunction with one another and other agencies as well, had been developing, spy planes like the U-2. I mean, there absolutely were things being developed which came to light decades later, which, of course, those in the know in government would have been concerned about, especially when we have people who suddenly take an interest in all these exotic aviation technologies, claim that they're seeing things. So there is an inextricable link between UFO phenomena and counterintelligence measures carried out by intelligence agencies in the United States and abroad. And yes, you're right. Some of that absolutely does have to do with the threat of those who would actually infiltrate government, or even if they're not within our own government, spies in action. Nonetheless, intelligence agencies who are monitoring what happens here on American soil around the world. So that's actually a really great point you make right there, Race.
Well, thank you, Mike. And, it's not to say, the degradation of traditions and history within a culture will undo a nation from the inside out. And it's important for us all to remember. I know it's easy, especially on a day like today, on Memorial Day, where you see stories about, I want to use a word on your show, but I'm not going to use it, but individuals who barrel across memorials in a car and mow down crosses and flags and they just complete lack of respect for those who have come before us, died for our freedom and for peace. And it's just a signal. It's a signal that our very moral fiber in this country is degrading, and it hurts me. It hurts me deeply. And it's because of a lot of disinformation that is spread through the internet, which cannot be completely controlled by the government, that has protected us from a lot of that stuff, from the 90s back, to the beginning of our time. And it should be noted that the government's not always perfect, and they're not always right, and they don't always tell the truth. Flight 800 was definitely covered up by the FBI and the federal government. Things like that happen. There's no question about it. I'm not sure about 9/11. I'm still in the air about that. I lean a little bit towards somebody knew something somewhere. Mm-hmm. But these things, they upset us. And then when we learn the truth about them, it's almost like you think, just like you would a best friend, how long has this sumbitch been lying to me all along? Mm. How long has the government been lying to me all along about everything? We're not perfect, and we've got a lot of work to do, but we also have to understand that we're a culture of people that have to stand together. We have to unite together, and we have to stand together, or we won't be.
Absolutely. And well said, in fact, Race, as always, although we are up on a break, so that'll have to be the final word for this segment. Although I will mention that later in the show, you may find that some of what Race was talking about there, in fact, mirrors a lot of these broader intelligence operations and maybe what relationship UFOs actually have with those kind of things. We'll save that for the second hour. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and I'm keeping you company as I always do, Monday nights from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, right here on our home on the web, kgraradio.com. Well, we had a lengthy first segment. Good to get that out of the way, because I think it sets the stage nicely for things yet to come. I will say this, however. Always question the reality around you. Do ask important questions, and don't just be dismissive. Don't just take everything at face value. See, that's the problem, I think, that we see with the polarization of attitudes, no matter what sphere one may be operating within, politics, the unexplained, religion, science. When ideas become polarized and people are fighting each other rather than trying to work together to understand the reality around us, our perception of reality is merely the distraction and the fight that ensues as a result of it, rather than actual progress. And if we're going to progress in the literal sense of actually progressing, we need to be able to ask questions, work together, and we need to be open-minded but discriminating with the facts before us. And when we see a lot of this weird stuff in the media talking about UFOs in strange ways, and we see strange things being released about UFOs, I think it sometimes does go a little deeper than just, well, yes, this is evidence of, or, well, that's obviously just bunk. Sometimes there are reasons, I think, why these kind of things may be presented to the public, and there is perhaps an element of conditioning to that. And there have been some very erudite writers, researchers, scientists who have commented on this. I mentioned Mark Pilkington, a friend of mine, another guy who I have immense respect for, but who I've never met, Jacques Vallée. We mention him often on this show. He's talked about that an awful lot just as well. And I'll share with you right now, before we get to a little news, a segment from one of his books called Revelations, Alien Contact and Human Deception. This may be my favorite book by Jacques Vallée, but in the introduction of the book, he says, for over 40 years, the phenomenon of unidentified flying objects has mystified hundreds of thousands of sincere witnesses, and yet the scientific establishment has refused to study it and stubbornly continues to deny the very existence of the mystery. The governments of the major nations have assembled countless dossiers on the subject, and in the course of military and intelligence data gathering, many remarkable facts have been accumulated, as we know from the few tidbits that the U.S. government has been forced to release under the Freedom of Information Act, and yet officials have never seen fit to declassify most of the files. So, a market has been created for the hoaxers, the charlatans, and those who are in this business of just selling dreams and delusions. Never mind that the few dedicated investigators who have patiently analyzed the sightings recognize that we are still far from a solution to the mystery. Eager believers have fabricated fanciful explanations out of whole cloth to provide belief and dogma where knowledge is lacking. Now, as I've shown in previous books, Dimensions and Confrontations, there is indeed a genuine UFO phenomena, and it constitutes one of the many mysteries that nature offers us. In my view, and this is Vallée writing, it represents an opportunity to practice some good science and to become aware of levels of consciousness we had not previously recognized. But the current proliferation of spurious material that confuses the real issues bothers me. It should be analyzed and exposed for what it is, which is at best a dangerous delusion, the germ of new cults that would extinguish the light of reason and free inquiry. At worst, it's an attempt to draw attention away from the real nature of the UFO phenomena, a deliberate effort to drive serious research into the quicksands of speculation. Not only have individual visionaries come forward with the definitive revelation that UFOs came from Venus, or Clarion, or Hoover, or Zeta 2 Reticuli, or hundreds of other places, but an entire cottage industry has grown around groups dedicated to the quote-unquote study of fantasies channeled by our kind space brothers from such unlikely places as Uma or the Pleiades. Organizations with mysterious sources of money are now springing up with dozens of local chapters all over the United States and Canada, and indeed all over the world. They hypnotize witnesses, they hold seminars and conferences, they edit expensive books and videotapes, and some even run their own presses. Their activity blurs the real nature of the phenomena and complicates its study. It adds another factor of confusion to the bewilderment of sincere witnesses who wonder what they have seen and who are looking for a helping hand. And things would not be so bad if only the hoaxers came from the lunatic fringe. Every field of endeavor has such borderline fanatics. Even well-established and dignified disciplines like physics with its entourage of perpetual motion inventors and medicine with its proliferation of quacks. No, there is more. Those who spend time in the field analyzing traces left by UFO phenomenon, interviewing witnesses, and assembling a study of the underlying patterns have now stumbled on evidence of a quite different sort, that some of the most remarkable sightings are actually complex hoaxes that have been carefully engineered for our benefit. The witnesses are merely the victims and the instruments, rather than the authors, of the hoax. And so to conclude here, what Vallée says, he asks, who is perpetrating such deliberate fabrications and what is their goal? There's no single answer to this question because there's no single source to human fantasy, no single reason for the deviousness of those military or civilian agencies that are spending our money to conduct secret psychological experiments, as the mind control projects of the 60s and 70s have abundantly demonstrated. So he goes on, and really I recommend this book, Revelations, Alien Contact and Human Deception. I recommend this strongly to anybody who would like to know a little bit more about the possible intelligence connections to the broader UFO narrative. And no, not all those who call themselves UFO researchers are people who are just looking to try and prove, quote-unquote, that alien life exists. I think that there's a lot more that we can learn from the study of UFOs. I've certainly done that, I think. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more in the next hour. First, a few items that have been trending in the news which have caught our attention here in the bunker. In Australia, there have been a string of earthquakes recently that shook Western Australia's goldfields region, and they have been described as having literally the proportionate strength of an atomic bomb blasting underground, rattling windows and sending locals fleeing outside. I read this and I thought, how long until someone says, well, it actually was an atomic weapon being detonated somewhere underground? You know, that has been done before in the past. That does not seem to be the case, however, this time. Hopefully this one is indeed natural, but it is indeed disturbing and has a lot of people talking.
An earthquake that's shaken WA's goldfields overnight has been described as being like an atomic bomb blasting underground. Three earthquakes hit near the town of Norseman and were reportedly felt as far away as Perth, more than 700 kilometres away. The first quake was a 4.9 magnitude tremor about 6 kilometres under the surface. It struck at about 11:30 p.m. The second, an hour later, was measured at 5.2, and a 3.2 magnitude tremor hit about 1:44 this morning. Seismologists say this is the largest event in WA since a magnitude 5 earthquake struck Kalgoorlie in April 2010, leaving buildings in ruins. Residents in WA's goldfields have taken to social media describing their experience. "I'm in Kalgoorlie, certainly felt it here. My three cockatiel birds fell off their perches and stayed very scared for several minutes. Second one, 5.1, lasted longer. Vibrated house like an express train going past."
And I'll point out, by the way, that these magnitude 5, again, that is what, according to experts, we actually see when a nuclear test occurs. Which is why, again, this is being likened again to an actual nuclear bomb blast. Rather interesting, of course, that they actually make that comparison. I found that kind of interesting. And speaking of large things, going even further down than down under, we're talking about into the ocean depths. Giant squids are something that have always fascinated me. And they're not only some of the strangest and elusive creatures on this planet, but there may be even larger ones than those which have already been documented. That's right, scientists have previously measured more than 130 different specimens. They say that the biggest that they've found right now is around 42 feet long, but the Daily Mail reported just yesterday that a new statistical study of these sea monsters does suggest that they could be much larger, as much as 65 feet in length. That's roughly the size of a school bus. Boy, wrap your arms around that one. Actually, it would probably like to wrap its arms around you. Now, this study was undertaken by Charles Paxton, a fisheries ecologist and a statistician at the University of St. Andrews. He says that the maximum sizes that this species might reach, again, could probably be a lot larger, and that based on the amount of data that they have right now about these creatures, although there are a lot of different interpretations of the size. Some people believe that they actually may be smaller and that these bodies that are found are actually stretched as a result of the ebb and flow of the tide that carries these things to shore. Now, Paxton, of course, had been focusing specifically on the beaks of these things. That's always been something really strange to me, too, that squids have beaks. What does an invertebrate have in common with a bird? Well, they do at least have that in common. And the beak is actually what's often found when these creatures' remains are found, if not actually washed ashore, if they're found within the gut of a creature like a sperm whale, which is the natural enemy of sorts of these deep sea monsters, the giant squid. And some of the beaks that have been found, along with the remains of other creatures in the bellies of the whales in question, do indicate that the creatures that have been consumed are larger than the specimens that have been found in whole. It's pretty interesting. Paxton says specifically that by modeling the relationships between beak size and then measurements of squid length, and then by looking at the sizes of the beaks that have been found, he says that indeed it seems like the biggest giant squid are indeed much larger than anything that we've seen yet. He says that purported squid of 10 meters, or standard length, and even 20 meters total length, are eminently plausible. Pretty fascinating stuff. Of course, we've got footage that's been obtained in 2004 by Japanese scientists. More recently, I believe that there was another one in which a live squid had washed far enough ashore that a man had actually swam alongside it. Did you see that footage? Those photos were incredible. And he said that the thing seemed kind of tired, but it tried to very slowly wrap its arms kind of around him. Not in a threatening way, like I'm going to eat you, but it was interacting with him, and he kept his distance, but swam right up next to the thing and filmed it. Boy, talk about having guts. Had to take some guts right there to swim alongside a giant squid. That's incredible. You know, the ancient mariners of yore believed in the existence of a creature called the Kraken. And many would just chalk the belief in such creatures up to pure fantasy. And then, as time goes on, not only do we learn that such creatures might actually exist, but that the ones that we've seen may not even be the biggest that are out there. And I don't think it's pure hope that is maintained when I say that there are probably as Paxton and others argue, much bigger creatures out there in the ocean deep than we've seen yet. We'll pick up with a little bit more news here on the other side of the break. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. Welcome back. Glad to be keeping you company as always as I broadcast to you from the dark heart of Appalachia, where in fact above ground the weather has been beautiful lately. Come down and visit. Hey, and by the way, if you can't make it all the way down here to the mountains, or up here I should say, it's easy to reach out to me, info@MicahHanks.com. I would love to hear from you. Don't be one of those people who, well, you know, I mean to reach out, I mean to touch base. You seem really nice. Or maybe you think I seem really glib, unintelligent, clownish, and unprofessional. Whatever you may think, I'm always happy to hear from people. I love to be able to interact with people who listen to this program. Unfortunately, the majority of you are wonderful people with wonderful attitudes and often who provide a lot of wonderful feedback. In the next hour, I'm going to get to a few messages from people like you out there who have sent along some really interesting tidbits this week. Right now from Twitter, my brother Dan James says, Micah, I doubt that anything of substance will be released by our government, even as far as FOIA. They may drop breadcrumbs, but that's going to be all. Well, that seems to be pretty much all that they've dropped thus far. Or they might just do what they did back in the days of the CIA's MK Ultra programs. You know, when the government actually gets called, well, I should say that branches of government call the CIA on what they were up to. And what is Richard Haynes, who at that time I think had been the director of the CIA, I believe, yeah, he orders that the MK Ultra files are destroyed. So we don't get to see exactly what they've been up to. Trust me, folks. Yeah, truth is often stranger than fiction. I guess that's just left to the imagination, the extent, indeed, of what they've been up to. Adam Olson there also says, Micah, here I've got Clayton Morris on hot dogs. Yeah. Clayton Morris. You know, Clayton did the funniest thing one time. Years ago, before he went to work for Fox, he had done a live news segment in which it was a parody. It was a very humorous thing, and that's something a lot of people don't get about Clayton. There's a very kind of underlying humor to a lot of what he does, which really is very much kind of the way that I operate just as well. I ought to get in touch with him more often. Actually, I like that guy a lot, but everybody's busy. That's just it. I mean, everybody's busy. That's just the reality of the world in which we live today. Another story I wanted to get to before we run out of time this hour. There's a 2,500-year-old body that was discovered in modern-day Tunisia. And a lot of researchers are looking at this one, scratching their heads. It may have really redefined, if not rewritten altogether, the history of human movement. Now, the remains of a Phoenician, dubbed the Young Man of Birsa, or Irike, provided the first ancient DNA of a Phoenician. And an analysis of that found that it contains a rare genome previously found only in ancient Europeans. Even though Phoenicians are from, that's right, the Near East, and this according to a research article published in PLOS ONE, the scientific journal, just last Wednesday. Now, this discovery, according to researchers, is causing us to really reconsider the history of human migration in the broader scope of things. Because, of course, it was previously thought that Near Eastern farmers had replaced European hunter-gatherers. Now, we have Lisa Madison Smith, who is one of the study leaders, and she wrote, as was reported by the Christian Science Monitor, that some of the hunter-gatherers' lineages may have persisted longer in the far south of the Iberian Peninsula and on offshore islands that were then transported to the melting pot of Carthage in North Africa, which through, of course, Phoenician and Punic trade networks. This is the earliest European lineage recorded in North Africa, and so in a way, it not only helps us understand Phoenician history, but it also makes people rethink the history of human mobility. You know, we're constantly learning new things about the way that our ancient ancestors interacted, the way that they got around, where they managed to get to. More and more as time goes on, I think that we're going to learn that there is indeed a history that is quite different from what many have supposed. We have to be very careful when we get so dogmatic. Boy, I feel like I say this all the time, probably because I do. But when we get too dogmatic about our ideals and the value we assert that the facts before us seem to have. I do recall Ivan Sanderson writing once, what is it about history that is so slow to change? Is it that people are just afraid that they may have to rewrite the history books? Well, yeah, maybe in part. But I have to also say that by the same token, again, as, well, Carl Sagan and many others have said in the past, extraordinary claims do require decent evidence at very least, if not extraordinary evidence. They at least need credible and decent evidence to substantiate these things. If something is going to indeed rewrite history, we have to have good evidence before we commit to the rewriting. And that's not just because we're worried about textbook sales. But this kind of thing is very interesting because what it seems to suggest is that as we learn more, we have perhaps at times taken for granted just what humans have been capable of. They always continue to surprise us, don't they? We continue to learn more and more about the ancient world, and we're always more and more fascinated with what we find. You know, back in 1994, gardeners had found in a sarcophagus near the National Museum of Carthage, again, the remains of this young man who has caused all this controversy. It's a good kind of controversy, but hey, again, it's certainly shaking up the world of history. And again, it's giving us this new picture of you know what historians consider one of the great early Mediterranean civilizations. The Phoenicians are said to have dominated the trade routes of the Mediterranean at that time. Originally from Lebanon, they expanded across the sea, bringing them with, of course, with them their highly prized dyes, their alphabet, other things just as well. They established cities in Carthage, just outside Tunisia's capital of Tunis, as well as the ancient cities of Tyre, Sidon, Byblos, Arwad, and other places. We know that there is evidence that the Phoenicians reached the Atlantic coasts of Spain and Morocco, and that they may have even circumnavigated all of Africa. Isn't that incredible? Maybe they did a lot more just as well. And it really reminds me, I don't know, I guess there probably wouldn't be any kind of connection with this, but you know, one of the enduring mysteries, and we've talked about it very briefly on this show in the past, the sea peoples that you hear in antiquity were referenced from time to time. That'd be an interesting one if we could find some sort of a parallel or some sort of an explanation for who exactly these individuals had been. Or maybe through the study of known groups, we will learn new things just as well that will help shed new light on old mysteries. It is the Graylian Report. We'll be back right after this.
Is the Graylian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Welcome back. It is the Graylian Report, and I remain Micah Hanks. Glad, as always, to be here with you. And, of course, as always, to bring you dispatches from the dark heart of Appalachia, this location known as the Graylian Bunker. Don't ask me where it is. It is fortified, it is secret, and you're only allowed access in one way. You can head right on over to graylianreport.com/X and sign up for Graylian X. That'll get you access to additional weekly podcasts as well as monthly specials would include Graylian enigmas, and from time to time we just throw all kinds of other stuff in there just as well. Lots to look forward to. Indeed. info@graylianreport.com, info@micahanks.com is how to reach me if you'd like to send along an email. We'll feature a few of your messages here in just a moment. You can also follow me on Twitter @MicahHanks. And a quick shout out to my younger brother Caleb Hanks, who provides a lot of the fine music you hear on this show. Many people ask every week, where do you get all your good music? A lot of it is Caleb. What you're hearing right now, that's actually yours truly on the old Gibson Les Paul Custom. Big time fan of Randy Rhodes and some of those fine guys who played those great Gibson guitars over the years. A little rock and roll, a little humor, a lot of science, and a lot of open-minded exploration. That's what you'll find on this program, The Graylian Report. Funny, from time to time, I do have people who will say things like, you know, this show needs to find itself. One of our reviews on iTunes had actually said that. And you can, of course, leave a review on iTunes just as well. It's always welcome. And the review had said, you know, wish this show could just find itself. Good show, but you guys are all over the place. Well, these days it seems like people kind of expect, even if you're going to be a paranormal show, they kind of seem to expect that you've got to pick one area, UFOs or Bigfoot. There was a kid who had referred to the show recently as a Sasquatch show and talked about how they didn't like it, that compared to other Bigfoot shows, this one just wasn't the best. They didn't say it that nicely, by the way. Problem is we might talk about that subject, you know, once every couple of months. I mean, I try to address a much broader range of material on this podcast. So, anywho, one of the things that we're going to be addressing later tonight, in the continuation of ideas we were kind of rounding out in the last hour, has to do with whether or not certain information may be presented for purposes of obfuscation, and also whether that information deals with UFOs, because of the kind of cover it might provide for other things. It's an interesting possibility, and in fact, I think there's probably a lot more legitimacy to it than many realize. That said, first, I would like to get to a few listener emails from folks like yourself out there. Tony writes, you know, there's this backstory behind the lyrics to this Fleetwood Mac song called Hypnotized from the early 1970s, and being from North Carolina yourself, have you ever heard about this incident? Tony, thank you for writing about this. It's funny that you'd mention that, because my good friends, who I mentioned earlier, in fact, Bill and Bob, formerly of Bell Laboratories, they came down to town here last summer, and they like to go out, and they enjoy good brews, they love good music, they're really interested in paranormal research and things like the Brown Mountain Lights. One night in particular, they said, why don't we just go over to your place, Mike, and we'll just, you know, jam around. We brought our acoustic guitar so we can have a little jam session, and being the really accomplished musicians that they are, Bob pulls out, like, you know, song sheets and chord charts, you know, we're doing Beatles songs and stuff, and Bill knows every electric guitar lick to every Beatles song ever written. So we have this really actually rather structured and awesome jam, and we're drinking good Asheville brews and things like this. And Bob says, hey, Micah, here's the song. Do you know this one? And that's the song that he played, and they actually, we jammed this particular tune. It's called Hypnotized by Fleetwood Mac. And the song, I think I've actually got a bit of a soundbite here of this, give you an idea of what it actually sounds like. Okay, so you guys, some of you might remember this particular tune. If not, go and listen to it, especially after we go down the rabbit hole here a little bit on this one. So Tony had asked, do I know the story behind it? And he links to the What's All This Then blog. And there had been on a discussion board a few years ago a guy who had said he'd grown up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And he had been checking out the online discussions about strange power spots, vortexes, you know, thin places, things like this. Well, he said one day back in 1969, he and three friends were riding dirt bike motorcycles in a large forested area near Winston-Salem. He described it as thick forest with bike trails worn through the woods, deep in the middle of the forest, and there was a large clearing that they had often visited before in this area. Well, they'd ridden their bikes there many times, but on this particular occasion, they get to this clearing, and rather than seeing a clearing, they were shocked to find a huge, perfectly round depression in the ground that was probably 80 to 100 feet in diameter. The guy said it was as if a giant iron ball had been pressed into the ground, buried halfway, and then somebody just lifted it right up. The dirt in the indentation, they said, was smooth as glass. There wasn't even a bump or a ripple anywhere. Of course, they thought it had been somehow man-made, maybe dug out with bulldozers, but there was no machinery anywhere. There weren't even any tracks, let alone any way for a caterpillar or something along those lines to be able to get down into this area of the deep forest. where this weird indentation, perfectly round, had been left. That's right, there were no roads, in fact, just bike trails that these guys would ride their dirt bikes on. Well, they got pretty spooked by this and decided to get out of there. And they go back to town, they told some friends. A couple of other people went down shortly thereafter. They said that they also saw the weird indentation. But within a few days, the depression was completely gone, as though it had never been there at all. Supposedly, someone had taken photos. To my knowledge, they've never appeared online or anything like that. But that story about this weird crater-like, smooth indentation in this field, out in the middle of the forest near Winston-Salem, became quite a little local urban legend. And within a couple of years, this song by Fleetwood Mac is released, Hypnotized. And some of the lyrics sounded almost identical. And a lot of people had begun to worry about that. Well, apparently there was, at FleetwoodMac.net, what was called the Penguin Q&A Sessions. Okay, there was a session, or rather a Q&A section on the website about this. And a researcher, apparently from Above Top Secret, had gone there and had been looking for quotes about what may have happened. There was a question that had been addressed to Bob Welch in 2003 that said, "Hey Bob, in Hypnotized you talk about a strange pond in North Carolina. What's the story behind it, and where's it supposed to be?" And this was sent along by Louis Golden, who is a resident of Charlotte himself. Well, Bob responds, "A guy that I used to work with from Winston-Salem told me the story of he and some friends riding dirt bikes 20 miles or so out into the woods when they came upon a strange crater in the ground with smooth sides like melted glass. It was a pond in the sense that there was some rainwater still in it, I guess. There were no access roads to that area, and so there weren't any kind of tracks left by caterpillars or anything that seemed to indicate a construction site." He said, "I think the location must have been near Winston-Salem. They all immediately got the feeling that they should get out of there. Maybe it was a meteor impact. I just like the imagery for the song." So needless to say, it seemed that Bob's story, as related in the song by Fleetwood Mac, had indeed actually had some basis in legend about something that a bunch of dirt bikers had encountered in the forest near Winston-Salem. I'd never heard that, but I remember when Bob and Bill were sitting in my living room and we were going over the song, he said, "Mikey, you should appreciate this. This seems to be a song about a real UFO." Who knows what it's really about, but it's an interesting story. Tony, thank you for writing with that. Chris writes, "Noon to you, Micah. Just a couple of quickies here. I've found your comments regarding artificial intelligence and its potential evolution into a threat resulting from how we see it to be especially poignant. I don't think you have to look very far to find explicit examples of just how occurrences in our modern world mirror this. I'd argue that much of our worst problems with terrorism have arisen due to early threat assessments and our actions toward preemptively quelling those threats. And I feel rather strongly that we have actually created the Middle East monster that we so much feared. So why would AI behave any differently considering our track record?" He said, "I also mentioned earlier that I had been reading Leslie Kane's UFO book and asked for recommendations based on an interest in the possibility of Cold War anxieties playing a large role in our government's handling of UFOs. Well, I finished Kane, and I took your advice, and I decided to grab a copy of Mirage Men by Mark Pilkington." Boy, Mark's getting mentioned a lot on the show tonight. We're going to have to get him on soon. He says, "I got to tell you, I think those two books should be required reading for anyone interested in the UFO topic, and I certainly agree. Those two books, again, are Leslie Kane's UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record, and then Mark Pilkington's book, Mirage Men." Now, Chris writes, "Kane does a fine job laying out some serious food for thought regarding actual military cases, and I just found Pilkington's case for government secrecy to be extremely well made out and enjoyably written. I did feel that Pilkington lost focus toward the end in regard to Dr. Kit Green. I mean, if nothing else, the book makes clear that anything that Rick Doty touches should be considered extremely suspect, and Pilkington was well aware that Doty and Green were longtime friends. Pilkington also makes a very strong case for UFOs being homegrown technology, which is something I felt Kane was quick to dismiss, but to be fair, she was dismissive largely because military personnel were dismissive as well. But that could mean very little, or a lot, and anything in between. Considering we were already utilizing radar ventriloquy by 1957, we had drones doing Mach 3 at 95,000 feet by 1967, and preliminary research on actual flying disc prototypes, I don't know, just some good food for thought. And as always, thank you, Chris, for writing." Hayden writes, "Mike, I hope this email finds you in fine fettle. I've been a Graylian for about 18 months now, and I became a subscriber to Graylian X a few months back after hearing you with Jim Harold. I have a season ticket to a football team in London called the Tottenham Hotspur, and on my walk from the station, I walk past a police box a la the Doctor. It always makes me think of you guys and makes me smile. He says, I would put myself firmly in the skeptical camp you place yourself in, especially when it comes to the whole subject of UAP. I found this today and I thought that you might find it of interest. And he links to an article from the BBC about a missing hiker named Geraldine Largay. Thank you for sending this, Hayden, and I must admit I did indeed see this. In fact, I've got an article coming up here in a few days at Mysterious Universe about this. Geraldine, we talked about it on the show here in the past. She vanished while hiking the Appalachian Trail. I believe she was in Maine. New FOIA documents supplied to the AP indicate not only that she was found, but also that her body was discovered in a makeshift camp within a collapsed tent that she had apparently put together herself. She had a cell phone on her and also a letter that was found with her body that indicate the events leading up to her death. Apparently what happened to Miss Largay is she had been hiking along the Appalachian Trail. At various intervals, she was meeting with her husband, who she could go and visit with in a hotel. She could take a shower, then she'd get back on. It was like a lifelong dream of hers, and she was in her 60s. She wanted to complete the Appalachian Trail. For most of the trip, she had a friend with her, and she would also meet other hikers along the way. But during this one particular, and what ended up, of course, being the critical stretch of the trail, it was about a 3-mile area. She had her companion hiking along with her, who chose to turn back. Geraldine continued on alone. This was her first mistake. Thereafter, she had had to take a bathroom break, and so she left the trail. She apparently went far enough from the trail to where she felt she could have enough privacy and became disoriented and was lost. When she got lost, she tried to head to higher ground and left, of course, moving further from the trail, presumably, to where she felt she could get cell phone reception and tried to text her husband. And she got further and further from the trail. She didn't manage to get cell phone reception and continued in vain to try and alert her husband that she was lost and that she was in danger. So upon discovery of her body in the collapsed tent, it was learned that many of the rescue efforts had passed within just a few meters of where her body was ultimately found. The text message attempts were found on the phone once it was powered and activated. And there was a note with the body which simply read, "When my body is found, please notify my husband and my daughter." With this case, unlike a lot of the purported missing 411 cases, what we are actually granted is a brief window into the life of Geraldine Largay and the events leading up to her demise. And what we learn from this are a number of the key things that you need to remember if you are a hiker, even if you're experienced. You are never to leave the trail. If you have to leave the trail, I think it's always wise to find a way to be able to plot points that will help you find your way back. You can keep a piece of twine or string, and you can put little flags down. As silly as that may sound, Miss Largay couldn't have gone that far from the trail, and yet nonetheless became disoriented enough that she was lost. And in trying to alert others to the fact that she was lost, in likelihood, went further from the trail. And of course, the number one thing that you always need to remember, never hike alone. And that's what she chose to do when her friend turned back. It's always good to hike in pairs or with a group. But as history has shown with a lot of these disappearances, even people who hike with groups still sometimes vanish. With Miss Largay, of course, what we now know is that a lot of these bad decisions contributed to her ultimate demise. And sad though it is, the one thing that we know, in addition to, of course, the family having closure and at least knowing that she was found, we also learn from this case the kinds of things that can become deadly. Simple though those decisions may be while you're there in the moment, they can be deadly if they aren't managed. So always be careful. Try not to stray from the trail, and always, if you can, hike with somebody. And thank you, Hayden, for sending that along. Matt writes, "Greetings, my American brother. How's life across the pond? I've been meaning to write to you for a while now and tell you about another interesting fellow that I met around a month or so ago." Now again, Matt, I've referenced a previous email from him more than once on this show in the past because it talked about a guy who was living off the grid, a so-called wild man who he actually spoke with and met with in England. He said, "I was out doing a little field research for a talk I'm going to be giving on Hillforts and high strangeness. My girlfriend and I were hiking around the Avon Gorge on the outskirts of the city of Bristol, where in an unrelated incident there was a report of a wild man last year. There are many other reports of various 4TN phenomena around the immediate area of the gorge and woodland, hence my interest, and so my girlfriend and I had visited two of three Hillforts that are all within a stone's throw of each other, It was whilst searching for these remaining parts that we took a small path that led us down the gorge, which I don't mind admitting really got my vertigo going. And it was whilst stumbling down this path that my girlfriend noticed a large hole in the ground. And peering in, we noticed a guy sat in what seemed to be a cave, and we were looking down through what would have been part of the roof. Well, we politely said hello, and he invited us into his home for a very British cup of tea. We clambered a little further down the gorge and located the cave entrance. We sat and talked with him for a while, learning that he had been living in the cave for some time now, and had left the normal everyday world voluntarily, and that he was only one of a long line of people who had stayed there in this cave. Now, the cave would be directly below where the hill fort would have been, so it's entirely impossible that he was the latest in a line of residents stretching back to the Iron Age, at very least. He lived a very basic existence and seemed very happy with his life. He sat cross-legged with a blanket wrapped around his body and over his head, which kind of made him look like a scruffy Indian mystic. All the best, brother, Matt Cook. Boy, Matt sends along some fabulous stories indeed, and you're all welcome to do the same if you have them and would like to share them. info@micahhanks.com is the way to do that. Here we are up on another break already, so when we come back, I want to kind of get to the heart of what's going to be the discussion that finishes up the program. It's going to be a bit of a wild foray in which we trace our steps back through the Himalayas in search of a mythical beast and all the way back down to South America and what one man may have actually played as far as a role in a strange cross-continental mystery. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Stay with us. One of those nights in the Graylian bunker, where it's always twilight. Welcome back, I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report. So much to get to, so little time. Precious, precious time. But I think I'm going to tie this in first and foremost. I mentioned Friendship Island in the last segment. If you're unfamiliar with what that is, I'll reference an earlier edition of the Graylian Report here, in which I had Walter Bosley on as a guest, but I also talked about Friendship Island, which set in motion a number of strange things, let me tell you. I was doing that show. We talk about this mysterious island off the southwest coast of Chile that night, and its apparent connection to certain UFO phenomena in Chile that was reported in the 1980s. That whole story I'll recap again here in a moment. I asked Walter Bosley about that, and we were interviewing him about his series of books called Empire of the Wheel. He was unfamiliar with the case, but lo and behold, once I catch my flight the next day to London, I'm in the Amsterdam airport the next morning, and I get a message as I'm checking my emails there from a guy named Peter Lavenda. Yeah, quite interesting. So I email Pete because while I'm giving my lecture in Leeds that weekend, someone stands up and they say, the story you're talking about this weird, you know, underground base on this island off the coast of Chile, sounds an awful lot like some of the stuff that Peter Lavenda's looked into. And I said, so funny that you'd ask that question. I think the guy that asked the question had been from Ireland, had come over for the conference. And I said, when I get back to the States, I plan to get in touch with him. And I did, and we interviewed Peter Lavenda on this program where he told about going down to Argentina. Actually, I guess he'd gone down to Chile, actually, yeah, in the 1970s, and he had traveled up into the Andean Mountains and had visited this weird little commune called the Colonia Dignidad. He was actually detained, and I don't know if you'd say he was deported, but he was told he had to leave the country. They booked him a flight, and he was sent home the next day. He was stopped along the way several times, had his papers checked, and then he was also kind of interrogated when he got back to the Miami airport. Now, he tells that entire story in his book that's called Unholy Alliance. Adam Sane of the Conspiranormal Podcast, who I happen to know as a listener of this program, he loaned me a copy of that book, and I reviewed that. And it's only deepened my interest in whatever that Chilean connection is to all this. So why then, if we're to try and understand what was happening in South America in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and perhaps still today, why would we begin our journey in the Himalayan mountains looking for a mythical beast known as the Yeti? Well, I'll explain that in a moment, because this is where things start getting really interesting. When you're a researcher of the unexplained, you'll find that often there are some unusual tie-ins that begin to appear. I hear, in fact, there's a new documentary searching for the scientific proof of the creature known as the Yeti that's going to be airing this Sunday night. And those of you who have access to televisions in your home, I recommend you check it out just as well.
There is some kind of biped creature out there.
Do you know of anyone who's actually seen a mirror?
There's a species in Tibet. The footprints look exactly like human.
I could see the footprints. This could be the real Yeti.
Mark Evans travels across the Himalayas.
It's a long way down.
People find new species in very unexpected places.
Revealing new evidence about the world's most intriguing legend.
The Yeti legend is based on a bear.
The way this is shaped is quite human.
If I can get DNA, I will be able to tell you what they are.
Yeti, myth, man or beast, Sunday at 8 on 4.
Now, BBC has covered the Yeti subject numerous times in the past, and I have to say I'm very pleased to see that there's so much interest in the scientific study of the creature. A previous installment of BBC Radio had not only talked about the previous studies that have taken place over the last several decades into trying to understand the scientific reality behind the Yeti, but they interviewed one of the true pioneers in the field of cryptozoology, Peter Byrne, a former British big game hunter who lives in the United States now. He'd have to be in his late 80s. By now, but they tell a unique story which involves a purported Yeti hand that had once existed in a monastery in Nepal. And the story about how they actually smuggled a finger from this out of the region, Peter Byrne, with the help of others, is truly fascinating. Strangely, it has a tie-in with the South American connection and this interesting Friendship Island thing, which we'll get to in a moment. But first, that unique story of Peter Byrne, in his own words, talking about the discovery of the Pambok Yeti hand and how they retrieved a piece and brought it back to London.
We were on a long 3-year Yeti expedition and moving through the Himalaya, and we found ourselves one day camped at a temple called Pambochi. And the temple had a number of Sherpa custodians. And one evening I was listening to them, and I heard one of them speaking Nepalese, which I speak. So we began to chat. We started talking about the Yeti, and then he told me that in the temple they had a hand of a Yeti, which had been there for many, many years, and would I like to see it? And so I said yes, and we went up in the evening time, and by candlelight he showed me the hand, and that's how it all began.
And what did it look like?
Well, it looked like a large human hand. It was covered with crusted, black, broken skin. It was very oily from the candles and the oil lamps in the temple. The fingers were hooked and curled. I seem to remember the forefinger had a long nail on it.
And what did you do then?
Well, I sent messages back to our sponsor, who was a Texan. There's a man named Tom Slick. And then he sent a message to one of the scientists who were working with us, and one of those was a Dr. Osmond Hill, who was prosector of the Regent's Park Zoo at that time. And he got a message to me, and messages went back and forth through India by cable with runners we sent up and down to the border. So it was a prolonged correspondence. It took 3 weeks to get a message out, get a message back. And he said, take a break and come and see us, come to London, and come meet with me and Mr. Slick and some others here, and let's talk about this hand and what we can do. So I flew to London, and we all met at the restaurant in the Regent's Park Zoo at a luncheon.
So not far from here, really?
Not far from here.
And what was agreed at the meeting?
Well, what Osmond Hill said was, you've got to get this hand. We want to see it. We want to examine it. But I had already asked the lamas there if I could have the hand, and they said no. It would bring bad luck, disaster to the temple if it was taken out of the temple. So I told Hill this, and he said, well, at the least you should try and get one finger, maybe cut a finger off and bring it back, get permission from them to do that. And I said, I'll have to replace it with something. And he said, well, you can replace it with a human finger. And he reached under the table and brought up a brown paper bag and tipped out a human hand onto the table, which was several months old and fairly dried. I've no idea where he got it from, and we never asked.
But this is when you're having a meal?
This is when we're having a meal.
That's a weird thing to do.
And Tom Slicht said, I take it that's not dessert. I remember him distinctly him saying that.
And you thought dinner with your family was weird. Yeah. Yeah, just wait until they pull out a human finger from a brown paper bag while you're dining and discussing Yeti. Anyway, Tom Slicht, of course, the guy who adds the punchline, I take it that's not dessert. Tom Slicht, also the guy who was financing this Yeti expedition. Tom Slicht, also the guy who had said, here's how we'll get that thing back to London. And he puts Peter Byrne in touch with a fellow by the name of Mr. Stewart, who turned out to be none other than Jimmy Stewart, the actor, who, along with his wife, were given the finger, brought it back, brought it through customs by smuggling the finger, yes, that's right, in Mrs. Stewart's own luggage. You can imagine where they put it. Yes, the lingerie container. So that no one would, of course, in order to respect the modesty of Miss Stewart. These days, she might not have gotten away with this, but back then, yeah, hiding the Pangbochi Yeti finger in her lingerie, managed to get it back without discovery. And so that's how they actually got it back. And that entire idea had been orchestrated by this guy, Tom Slicht. Now, I've heard that name for years. And it was very interesting to me because Tom Slicht, I knew, and there's a bit of an interesting kind of synchronistic tie-in here, but I knew he had been interested in cryptozoology because there was a great book written by Lauren Coleman a number of years ago. And that book, I believe, was called Tom Slicht, True Life Encounters in Cryptozoology. Although I think Lauren had written another book about that, which had actually been a much earlier book called Tom Slicht and the Search for the Yeti. So who is this Tom Slicht? Well, as Peter Byrne described, he was a San Antonio-based inventor, businessman, adventurer, and he'd also been an heir to an oil business, which led to his philanthropy and his pursuit of funding research into mysteries. He had funded the Yeti expeditions. He had also helped fund Bigfoot research that Byrne and others had been involved with. He had funded a similar expedition in search of the famous Loch Ness Monster. His actual full name, by the way, is Thomas Baker Slicht Jr. Hence, of course, yes, there's a Whovian tie-in. He shares the name of the fourth Doctor, Tom Baker, at least in part. Tom was an interesting guy. In addition to funding research into these various cryptozoological mysteries, he founded several research organizations, too. For instance, the Texas Biomedical Research Institute in 1941, followed by the Southwest Research Institute in 1947. Now, the Southwest Research Institute is interesting enough because that organization, of course, had been involved with a number of different engineering and physical science innovations. They've been looking at everything from robotics to applied physics, planetary sciences. Very interesting stuff. And, of course, in 1947. Now, I'm sure it's probably coincidental, this, of course, being the same year that Kenneth Arnold famously sees these objects flying over Mount Rainier. The following month, of course, we have a purported crash landing of something at Roswell, New Mexico. The same year, of course, Southwest Research Institute is founded by Tom Slicht. And, of course, he also went on to found, in 1958, what was known as the Mind Science Foundation. And that one's maybe the most interesting of them all, a private nonprofit scientific foundation, once again in San Antonio, Texas, which is aimed at, quote, raising awareness and levels of funding for one of the major unsolved questions in science, how consciousness arises in human beings. Quite interesting. So that seems to be what the aims of that organization remain today because they're still in operation. And all of these things founded and funded by Tom Slicht, who died in 1962, and I should note he died under rather weird circumstances. He'd been returning from a hunting trip in Canada. His airplane, it says, crashed in Montana, but what they actually say, according to the report that I believe was carried in the Chicago Tribune, was that the aircraft disintegrated in flight. I mean, this is really bizarre because around that same time, well, actually, I guess a good bit earlier, there was another instance where a aircraft mysteriously crashed. Coming back from, of course, investigation into the Maury Island UFO incident, the two Air Force, and this was actually on the day that the Air Force finally made its divide from the U.S. military, two agents who had been investigating the Maury Island UFO case died in a crash, which made them the first two casualties under the newly formed U.S. Air Force. Yeah, but Tom Slick's plane purportedly disintegrated in flight. I tried to find that article in the news banks, you know, the classic news archives and whatnot. I couldn't find it, but I'd love to try and dig that up. Now, what does Tom Slick and the search for the Yeti and all of this have to do with South America? That's probably what many people are wondering, but I guarantee you there are some interesting tie-ins with all of this. I mentioned recently that I finished the book Secret Machines by Tom DeLonge and A.J. Hartley. And I was really pleased to find that throughout this book, not only do they tie in a lot of the Nazi innovations during the Second World War and the escape of certain Nazi war criminals to South America. They talk about Operation Paperclip a lot in the book. I don't want to give too much away, but they really weave a lot of interesting history that has a lot of conspiratorial kind of tie-ins with the UFO phenomena. They tie a lot of that into this book, and it's really well done. And this, of course, has a lot to do with my own interest in this purported case involving this mystery island off the southwest coast of Chile. Some say it's right near Chiloé Island, more specifically around the area of Puerto Montt. And, of course, after I talked about this on my own show, Peter Lavenda listened to the program and got in touch with me and said, you know, this sounds an awful lot like something that happened to me back in the 1970s. He comes on the show. We talk about this. The Friendship Island case has long been associated with UFOs because one of the earliest people to have claimed contact with these islanders had been a man named Ernesto de la Fuente. And he had been, of course, kind of thrust into the spotlight as a result of not only alleged paranormal experiences that he had, but also his purported contact with these beings. Over Santiago, Chile in 1986, there was a bright light seen hovering in the sky, and many, after the television coverage of the purported case of Ernesto de la Fuente, a lot of people said this light was the Friendship, that this was one of their aircraft, that they were, you know, the Holy Brothers or the aliens or whatever else might be out there on this island. Well, at the Magonia blog, which at one point had also been a print publication, there was an article that had been featured called Friendship, the Fantasy Island, and they debunked the entire thing. And it is well known now that the light that was seen over Santiago in 1986 had indeed been a weather balloon that had been launched from South Africa, and within a few weeks had managed to drift over Santiago, and people saw it. Yeah, once again, a weather balloon mistaken for a UFO. The problem is that the entire Friendship affair was debunked largely on its association with these rather dubious UFO instances. Now, remember at the outset of the program, I said, from studying unexplained phenomena, often what you begin seeking versus what you find at the resolution are very different things. I became interested in the Friendship case once Miguel Romero, a.k.a. the Red Pill Junkie, had put it to my attention and said, you know, you should check into this, man, because often, as is usually the case, in fact, with UFO research in America, in the United States especially, we completely disregard famous cases that occur in other parts of the world. And so when I'm talking with, you know, people in this community, you know, I bring to their attention, do you guys know anything about Friendship Island? Most have never heard of this. But as my research has shown over time, I think it has less and less and less to do with anything ufological at all. What is interesting is the fact that there are certainly other things that have come to light over the years that seem to suggest that there is something more going on. There's a Latin American blog that I managed to find recently, in fact, and this, of course, entirely in the Spanish language, it is called isla-friendship.blogspot.com. And with the wonder of Google Translate, now you can, of course, translate these websites very easily and you can read the information. And there are some interesting articles on this website. One of them, in fact, involves an account given by a man who said that he had worked alongside a German man. And on one occasion, one of the co-workers, a welder, had asked this man, "Where did you come before you came to live here?" And the German man said, "Isla Friendship." And to his surprise, the welder replies, "Ah, that's the island out south where all the aliens live." And he said that the German man had a surprised look on his face. He turned his head and didn't speak for the rest of this bus trip that they were all on together, apparently shocked at the fact that the guy knew where he was talking about. An even stranger story related at the website talks about a couple, one woman from Chile herself, who had married a man from New Zealand. He liked to adventure. He owned a boat. And they'd spent a lot of time out boating together. And he had said that he wanted to go all the way up to Chile together. And so she followed over. He had gone earlier a few weeks, flown to Chile, met with a friend, they rented their boat, and that they'd been sailing around Puerto Montt. When they said that as they were arriving at the entrance of a particular channel, they encountered a large white yacht, similar to theirs, but much bigger. They could even see the name written along the side. It was Miteluz II, which of course is the famous yacht that's been associated with the friendship in the past. The narrator writes that it crossed the mouth of this entrance perpendicular to them, and it's a little difficult, you have to try and read these translations, but apparently they said that there was a cable towing something underwater behind this ship, which crashed into the stern of their own boat. Well, of course, when they become aware of the fact that something has hit their boat, they stop, and then the Miteluz comes back around, and there are men, gringos they describe them as, on board this boat, and they come over, and they are talking with the New Zealander and his friend and his Chilean wife. Initially, they begin speaking in Dutch, but when the New Zealander starts speaking English, they speak English just as well. And they offer to pay for the damages to their boat. And they pay a portion in cash, and then they also provide these blocks of an interesting-looking metal of some sort. It turns out to be platinum. And as the woman says, that when they go back to New Zealand, that they find not only that the cash, of course, is good, but that a metallurgic analysis of the platinum, the nuggets of platinum that they were given, it seemed to indicate that it was 99.98% purity and not a natural formation. It was very interesting. The letter that appeared at the website had actually been written to Ernesto de la Fuente. I wonder if it ever got to him, because he ended up kind of stepping out of the limelight after the ridicule he received after telling this story. What's interesting is that, as covered in a previous episode of the Graylian Report, there are numerous similar correspondences and stories like this one that have been collected and retold over the years. Again, I recognize that part of the problem for U.S.-based researchers is the language barrier. But, you know, digging a little deeper, you know, trusting, you know, friends who are bilingual and who are able to translate, and also, when it's web-based information, you can use Google Translate. Going to the extra effort begins to release little details over time, and a weird story has sort of begun to emerge. Again, to me, it seems less and less that the story of the friendship is a secret alien base out there off the southwest coast of Chile. There was an article written by a guy named Josep Guiaro years ago titled "Who Hides Behind the Friendship?" And in that article, there's a lot of interesting information that comes out about independent investigations in Latin America into the possible veracity behind some of the claims of the friendship. One of the things that had apparently involved a Chilean sociologist and his own research into this, and more specifically into whether there were mind control or some sort of kind of sociological experiment going on with the release of this information about this friendship. This researcher, Rodrigo Fuenzalida, the sociologist and the president of a group called the AIOM, who went out looking for possible evidence of the friendship. And he had also said that he'd gone about imitating the voice of the friendship characters over the CB radio, which was one of the primary means of communication that these characters had purportedly carried out. And he said that indeed he had actually found that a lot of people believed him when he pretended to actually be portraying these characters out on this island via the CB radio communications himself. But that wasn't all that he found. He also had found that there were other interesting things that came to light. He had tried to trace some of the transactions purportedly made by the islanders when they came to the mainland, where they purportedly had come and they would buy cattle, but they always bought sick cattle and things like this. Well, Fuenzalida said that, interestingly, a number of these groups, of course, or the people in these groups, had utilized names like Michael, and like Raphael, angelic names, classical names. But he finds that Rather interestingly, they had paid cash and also had used checks, and that the names on the checks had not necessarily been the same names that they used. One name, in fact, had been Andrea Nisbeti, who, according to Fuenzalida, had, quote, entered the country using a passport made out to Antoni Isbeth. But it was a phony document. Fuenzalida said the information on Andrea Nisbeti was given to me by an engineer who was in contact with them. It turns out that there was a scientist by this name, a colleague of Wernher von Braun. Of course, at that time, when the Russians and the Americans divided up the Nazi scientists, this one, Nisbeti, went along with the Americans, who later lost track of him. Which seems to, of course, be a reference to Operation Paperclip. Could it be that there were Paperclip scientists involved with some of this? That's an interesting possibility. But that's not all Fuenzalida said. He also said this, and this is what really kind of caught my attention. He had been talking about the fact that he'd been trying to trace some of these business transactions. He said he learned that business matters with these check transactions had been transacted by, quote, the Mind Science Foundation. The Mind Science Foundation, you'll remember, of course, was that very same organization founded by Tom Slick in 1958, founded for purpose of consciousness research. When I heard that, I mean, my jaw just dropped. We're almost out of time, but I've got just enough time to share one more thing with you. Because I've begun to wonder, you know, whatever was happening, maybe it was only active, maybe it was only going on back then. That is, in the 80s and 90s. Maybe this does tie into Operation Paperclip. Maybe this does tie into, you know, some of these post-war Nazi conspiracies and things like that. Maybe it's just a group of people. Maybe it's, again, nothing ufological per se, but maybe it's the closest approximation to what we might call a breakaway civilization, as Richard Dolan has discussed in the past. But this is what's really interesting. The most recent thing I've managed to find, this is maybe a game breaker, I don't know. 2009. There was an advertisement that I found that appeared in a Chilean newspaper, which is published in Puerto Montt, Chile. The advertisement, however, it being a Spanish language publication, was weird because it was in English. I want to read to you what this little classified ad, it ran for 3 weeks. I want you to hear what it says. It read, "To Friendship Island, I am the professional engineer whose house you visited in Sarasota, Florida about 2 years ago. You scared me at that time because I did not know who you were, but now I know. I would appreciate it if you would let me visit your home. Thank you." 2009. What the hell does all of this mean? I don't presume to know. But as I dig deeper, I find over time increasingly that I'm of a mind to believe, maybe a science mind, that this has a lot less to do with UFOs. And I do wonder sometimes if the UFO subject isn't a convenient cover for other kinds of things that may be going on in the world. Maybe not nefarious things, and maybe not things per se going down that kind of rabbit hole that we might tend to go down from time to time that would lead us to think mind control or other kinds of things. But I definitely think at very least that there is a bit more substance that many overlook because they don't dig deeply enough. And it's a fascinating story that comes out over time with a little bit of persistence. That'll be the final word for this week's edition of the program. I am Micah Hanks, and on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Headquarters, Caleb Hanks, Chris Hayes, Matthew Oakley, Jeremy London, Tyler Pittman, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Race and Robin Hobbs, and yours truly, I remain Micah Hanks. info@MicahHanks.com to reach me, and @MicahHanks on Twitter. We'll talk to you again soon, and as always, guys, stay strange out there.
You've been listening to The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.